Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we are going to stay in Europe. We're not actually there. We wish we were there, but we're not there. Maybe in the future, we will go over and visit Stuart, our guest from last week. And then we will head over to Brussels and talk to our guest today, who is a public affairs expert in Brussels, which has to be the most complex government system on the planet. And so today we are going to talk to Kasa Stenström, who is founder and managing partner at Stenström Consulting in Brussels. And she came recommended to us by Stuart, and I guess they have worked together. And so we are going to stay over in Europe. Maybe someday we'll actually be there in person and get a tour from Kasa of all things Brussels. But Kasa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'd be happy to have you here in Brussels. I can't wait.
Well, we said the same thing to Stuart. We're going to be possibly adding some video to the podcast. And so we're going to go a little bit on a tour and visit different capitals. And so if we come to Brussels, you will have to be our tour guide.
With pleasure. I'll show you the French fries, the best ones.
Yes, yes.
And the best beers and wines.
Yes, we have heard that. Everyone who has traveled Europe knows that that's what Brussels is for. So before we get into your career, can you explain the basic government system in Brussels, the different components, and how one would interact with that?
Sure. How many hours do you have?
It's a podcast. We have unlimited time. We try to keep it under an hour, but as simple as you can.
No, as you were saying, it's a very complex system. And I think the main ingredients are the three major institutions. So you have the European Commission, you have the European Parliament, and you have the Council. The Council is the most, I think, the institution which is the most difficult to explain because it represents the 27 member states.
Okay.
And so you have these three institutions, Commission, Parliament, and Council, negotiating all the laws between them.
And so where do you spend most of your time in one of those entities?
That's a very good question, because I think that quite a lot of lobbyists spend a lot of time working with the Parliament, because mm-hmm. that's where things get a bit more, vocal or more media attention. But it is very, very important to engage with the Commission early on in the process. That's one of the key recommendations, to really be upstream in the decision-making process and interact with the Commission long before they put a legislative proposal on the table.
Got it. So is the Council made up of 27 entities?
That's right. So every country has their representation in Brussels, the permanent representations. We refer to them as the perm reps. We have a lot of jargon here, lots of abbreviations. Many of them are based on French words. So that's part of the job, to know the glossary.
Brussels may be the only place on the planet that has more acronyms than Washington, D.C.
Exactly. And we have an association for anything, you know, olive oil producers or candle makers, or all of them have their EU representative association here with very interesting names.
So the 27 members, that's the Commission or the Council?
That's the Council.
And does each country have one member, or is it, how does that work? How do you interact with the body?
So each country has an ambassador representative, but then the representations are actually made up of around 100 experts from the member states that negotiate the various files. And then when the council meets, it meets in different configurations. So if the health council meets, it's the 27 health ministers, but they only meet a certain number of times per year. So in between those meetings, their statements or their dealings are prepared by the sort of lower hierarchical levels. And the council meets at working group level with the health experts that are based in the permanent representations in Brussels.
And how many members are there in Parliament?
Oh, Parliament is now 750 members approximately, and it's grown over the last years. And also it's the powers of the Parliament have grown and changed. And they are putting more and more, I think, pressure on the Commission to do things a certain way.
Okay. And what's the role of the Commission?
So the Commission is the only body of these three that has the right to put forward the legislative proposals. So that's why it has a very important role in the structure. And that's why, in terms of lobbying, it's so important to deal with them very early on and give them, you know, facts and figures on the impact of their proposals. So I think that's quite different from how things work in the countries. And the Commission is also a complex body. Sorry to add to the complexity again. But the Commission is, of course, made up of different departments and directorate generals, or DGs, as we call them. And they all have very nice acronyms as well. We have the one that deals with health, for example, that's referred to as DG Santé, which is an easy one because that's health in French. But then we also have DG FISMA, which is DG, the Director General for Financial Services, essentially. And so these different departments then prepare the legislative proposals that the Parliament and the Council then have to debate.
When you mentioned how large Parliament is, I can't imagine. Well, I mean, you know, the U.S. Congress has 435 members, but that is quite a large body to have to navigate. I would imagine you deal with leadership a lot, or committee chairs and that type of approach.
Indeed. And the Parliament is also interesting because the way the members of Parliament here, we refer to them as MEPs, how they sit is according to their political group belongings and not according to nationality. So it's a quote unquote real parliament in that sense. But it makes for very interesting parliamentary groups because you will have very wide variations of actual sort of political beliefs within one and the same group, depending on whether your MEP is from one country or another country. Because I don't think that, for example, the conservatives in, let's say, Sweden necessarily are the same conservatives that you will find in Poland, yet they will share the same European political group and they are supposed to vote more or less according to the same lines in Parliament. But that's also why it's so important as a lobbyist to work not only vis-a-vis the political groups, but also have in mind the nationality so that you make sure that you have enough members voting in your direction.
How many political groups are there?
We have 8 political groups, you can say, but they're still, sometimes they are reshaping. So sorry to be unclear on that, but groups are moving within the groups and some groups are expelled from other groups.
What is the largest, or what are some of the largest groups?
So that would be the Conservative group and then the Socialist group and the Liberal group. The Green became much bigger in the latest elections. But the classically, it's the Conservatives and the Socialists with the Liberal runner-ups. But then we've also seen many more extreme groups also growing in the last few years and taking more center stage. So the political landscape has changed a lot.
And is that on both sides, the right and the left?
I would say on both sides, yes.
Okay. So I would imagine that public affairs or lobbying, is it a big business in Brussels? Is there a lot of lobbying public affairs firms?
A lot of lobbying public affairs firms in Brussels. We were just saying that I haven't looked at the statistics recently, but I would say easily 20,000 people. And there is a register, transparency register set up by the institutions where you can actually check the numbers. And you will see that there are both small independent firms, and then, of course, the big players as well. Now, I just wanted to mention that I've been involved in my career here as in an organization that represents Brussels lobbyists. It is called SEAP, the Society of European Affairs Professionals. I was on the board for many years, and SEAP works on issues such as transparency and ethical behavior on behalf of lobbyists, making sure that lobbyists act ethically.
Yeah, we have the same thing here at the state and the federal level, where at least people have to file what they're doing. It's usually called an ethics report. I would imagine, is there any education component to that? How does one in the U.S., typically, if you're going to learn how to lobby, people would come off the hill, join a firm, and learn from mentors. Is that the similar system in Brussels?
No, it's a good question. I think a lot of people here will have in their background, you know, political science, economics, law, and languages, because that's always played a big part, perhaps less so now that English has taken over, but that wasn't really the case when I moved here, at first when French was more dominant. But I think at the beginning of my career, there was certainly the flow of parliamentary assistance, first doing a couple of years at the parliament and then moving into the lobby business. But then, to be honest, the parliament changed their reward structure or the salary structure for MEP assistants. And I think it was difficult to sort of poach MEP assistants and get them into the private sector because we're challenging sort of, you know, salary competition. It was hard to attract assistants over on a beginner's salary level in the private sector. So I think because of that, we now see many MEP assistants working for many, many more years in the parliament before they transfer to the lobby firms.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Okay. And so your practice, do you practice in a certain area or is it widespread? Tell us about your practice.
It's very widespread and by choice because I love the variety. I work in financial services, in health, in energy environment, in artificial intelligence, many different sectors and types of businesses and organizations. That's how I love it. So it's very challenging and interesting.
Wow. How has Brexit impacted things in Brussels and your practice?
Well, that's been a very sort of dominant debate now over many, many years, and I have clients who've been directly affected. So I've spent many a night doing, you know, Brexit analysis before the big vote and then when the vote had taken place. And it's been, of course, intellectually stimulating and interesting, but also a bit frustrating because this was a first time for so many. So a lot of the debate was speculation, and I like things to be a bit more concrete than that. So for the first couple of months or years, I can't even remember how long the process has been, there was a lot of conferences about the potential impact and the potential way things could go. And that towards the end was I guess we all got Brexit fatigue, as we would call it. But now, of course, it's more clear what the implications are. But having said that, we're still trying to figure out concretely for some of our clients how they will be affected going forward, because this is where it all starts, really.
Right. So even though a lot of it is behind you, it still really now almost begins with trade negotiations and everything else, trying to operate under the new reality. So now that all the uncertainty is over and it's a reality, but now you have to deal with the reality of interacting under this new regime, this new framework.
That's right. That's right. Yes. So we will be continuing with Brexit. I mean, I think most lobbyists in Brussels have done Brexit work in one way or the other. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us about your career. You're obviously bilingual. You speak French. Any other languages?
French is my second language. I would say that English is my third language, Swedish being my first.
Swedish, French, and English. English is your third language.
Yes, and then I also speak in a couple of other languages, but that's nothing special by Brussels measures. Really, it's very standard.
That's incredible. So you grew up in Sweden?
I did, in a small town on the Swedish west coast, and moved when I was 18 to the big wide world. And then I ended up in Paris, where I did my university studies, almost all of my studies there. I did 4 years, a bit more than 4 years in France, hence, you know, French being my second language. So I was the only non-French student at the Sorbonne Paris, where I studied, which was an adventure in itself, and it was wonderful.
That's great.
And eventually, I added political science to that. I studied history in France and other languages, and then I added political science and European affairs. And of course, then I was, you know, drawn to Brussels, and I came here to first finish my studies, if I remember correctly. And then I ended up doing what we call a stage, which is an internship at the European Commission.
Oh, wow.
For 6 months. And then I stayed on. And that, I think, is a very traditional path for many, many lobbyists in Brussels.
Yes. Well, many lobbyists really everywhere. What was your internship like?
It was great. I was at the DG. I don't know if you remember the DG's Directorate General, but mm-hmm. I was at the DG for Trade and External Relations. It was one department at the time. And I was dealing with trade and investment relations between the EU and Asia.
That's great.
It was a lot of fun.
And you liked it?
Yes, very much.
And then when you left your internship, what did you do?
Then I went to work for the law firm DLA. DLA Piper. So back then it was a smaller firm, a British firm, did Lupton Alsop. That's where I met Stuart, who you mentioned at the beginning of our talk. Mm-hmm. And we set up the very novel concept of a public affairs department within a law firm. And we called it the Washington style. And I know it's very common where you sit, but in Brussels, I would say even still to date, it's not really that common. So that's what we did. And it was very exciting few years. And I stayed at DLA for 8 years. I was head of the Brussels lobby department, and then also director of Continental Europe, because the firm kept merging and grew over those years. And for every new country that was sort of acquired, my role was to make sure that we had the correct public affairs capacities in place in those countries.
Yeah, and DLA Piper has a very large presence here in the U.S.
Yeah.
So you and Stuart have a real entrepreneurial streak to start that public affairs group within a law firm like that. How did you get that idea?
Well, I wouldn't take the credit for getting the for setting up the overall idea. There were more than Stuart and I around, and it was led by our boss at the time, Lord Tim Clement Jones, who really I think was the one who had the concept. Mm-hmm. And then we implemented, and I was in charge of the Brussels side of things, and we grew the team over those years. And I think when I left, we had maybe 8 or 9 people in the lobby team. And mm-hmm. of course, the law firm had grown to very big proportions by then.
And at that time, Stuart was in the London office?
Yes.
Okay. And did you start your own firm when you left DLA Piper?
Exactly. So I left to set up my own.
And so how is it being on your own versus being part of a larger entity? Which do you like better?
Oh, as I mentioned to you before, I really enjoyed my years at DLA. I have very, very fond memories of those years, and it was a great experience. But equally, I loved doing my own thing. Now I couldn't dream of going into a bigger structure. And, you know, there have been, I guess, opportunities for me to do that. But I'm now so clear on the fact that I want to do this my own thing. Maybe it's to do with age as well. Like, I couldn't picture myself being part of anything else right now.
Because you've had your own correct, your own firm for a while.
Yeah.
And you have a family. So you're used to being, you know,
in charge.
Running things. Yeah, in charge. Yes. Is there a certain part of the year that is busier for you than other parts?
Well, I'd say it's always running up to Christmas or running up to the classical European summer break. There are always things that have to be wrapped up by the institutions and by everyone else. Mm-hmm. But more than on a yearly basis, I think what's interesting is the five-year cycle that we have here. When we have the European Parliament elections and the installation of the new College of Commissioners, that happens every 5 years. And that sort of sets the rhythm for the political priorities and the outflow of proposals. And first, the new commission will always come out with their strategies on their big priorities for the 5 years, much like any national government would do. And then they will transform those strategies into more, slightly more concrete action plans. But then they are still quite abstract. And then they will move on to the hard law proposals. And that's pretty much where we are this year, I would say. So this year is a particularly busy year because the Commission has been talking over several years now about what they want to do in artificial intelligence or environmental or energy laws, just to give a couple of examples. And now is where that's going to happen. So we will have our new AI proposal in a couple of weeks' time. And this summer, we will have a whole package of energy-related proposals. And that's where the sort of hard and fun stuff really begins for us as lobbyists.
And so will most of that be wrapped up before the August summer break?
No. So they will put out these proposals, and then those proposals by the Commission have to go through the cycle with the Parliament negotiating amongst them, the text, the Council negotiating amongst them, the 27, the text. And then when each of these have found a position, the three institutions, Commission, Parliament, and Council, will have to negotiate the final deals. And that can take anything from 10 months to several years. Mm. But the idea is that most of the proposals should be agreed by the time we get to the next European Parliament elections and the new commissioners are sworn in. So they have to sort of close their cycle. So we have a couple of years now to wrap up all the lawmaking, essentially.
Well, Casa, this has been great. We very much appreciate you taking the time during this busy time of year and this busy year for you. It was great to meet you, and a shout out to Stuart for recommending you. And when and if we ever get back on the road, we'll have to come to Brussels and get the in-person tour. But we wish you all the best in the coming year.
Thank you so much. It's been great speaking with you, and I'm here ready and waiting for when you get over.
All right. Well, the political life is going to have to hit the road. And for our listeners out there, remember, you can follow us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and everything else. You can also sign up for our Monday email. It used to be Monday morning, but, you know, sometimes we're late. It's a busy year. So you can sign up for that at our website, thepoliticallife.com. It comes out every Monday with the show. And we hope you have a great and safe week. And we will see you next Monday.